I'm Rebecca Ibarra, host and producer of NPR and WNYC's Consider This, filling in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Last summer, the brutal killing of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis set into motion a national reckoning about systemic racism and police brutality. Floyd's death, which was captured on camera and viewed by millions, illustrated the unequal justice system that Black Americans have experienced for far too long. A 2020 study from Harvard found that Black Americans are three times more likely to be killed by police than white Americans. The names of those who've died at the hands of police have become a rallying cry for change. Breonna Taylor, Rayshard Brooks, Daniel Prude, Atatiana Jefferson. The list keeps growing. And while the trial of Derek Chauvin, the officer accused of killing George Floyd, is scheduled to begin shortly, history has shown how difficult it is to secure an indictment against a police officer, let alone a conviction. For more, we're here with Josie Duffy Rice, president of The Appeal, and Aaron Morrison, national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. Josie and Aaron, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, good to be with you.
Aaron, the killing of Ahmaud Arbery was caught on video. He was shot three times in broad daylight while he was on a run because three white vigilantes thought he was involved in nearby robberies. Remind us how local prosecutors initially handled this case.
Well, they initially handled it by, let's just be blunt, by not handling it. They did not afford Mr. Arbery the civil rights protections that you know, others would get in a what is clearly a criminal case. So, and a very heinous act that was carried out by the McMichaels. So that's the reason why his mother, Wanda Cooper, has filed a civil rights lawsuit just recently on the 1 year anniversary of his death.
And where do things currently stand with the trial of the men charged with his murder?
Well, they essentially await trial. A trial date has not actually been set yet. So we're a few days past the 1 year since Ahmaud's death, and the family is still awaiting, you know, basically a roadmap for how things are going to proceed.
Josie, what sort of defense are the three men charged in Arbery's murder planning on using?
We're basically expecting to see them use two different defenses for their actions that day. The first is employing the citizen's arrest law, which has existed in Georgia law since the year that the Emancipation Proclamation was signed. That's relevant because this law really has racist origins and has been employed in explicitly racist ways, right? So it essentially gives citizens, or especially white citizens, the right without, you know, to use the force of law to arrest people using the force of law, though they don't have law enforcement credentials. And what we see is that it plays out in similar situations like the one with Ahmaud Arbery. They also plan to use what is essentially a stand your ground law, basically arguing that Ahmaud Arbery, you know, came at them after they tried to arrest him, and in his aggression made it reasonable for them to shoot and kill him. You can see how together these two laws really allow, if employed liberally, really allow anyone to get away with shooting and killing whoever they want for the suspicion of even the slightest infraction, right? I mean, the argument that they were attempting to arrest him, but they were also acting in self-defense really doesn't align unless you are in a place like Glynn County.
Last June, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed a hate crime measure into law in response to the reaction to Arbery's death. Before that, Georgia was one of only four states that did not have a hate crimes statute. Kemp has also proposed overhauling that Civil War era citizens' arrest law that you mentioned, Josie. So how significant are these changes?
Look, I think it's important to acknowledge some of the ways in which Ahmaud Arbery's death was systemically endorsed, right? And I think that the fact that Georgia is one of four states without a hate crime law, you know, is a relevant data point. That being said, I find that very often, and especially very often in southern states, I'm in Georgia, these laws end up being used against the very people that they're meant to protect, right? You see in places like Louisiana, where now police are a protected class under the under a hate crime law, right? You see under you see in other states where actually any additional criminalization tends to primarily hurt Black and brown people, poor people, not actually the people that this is maybe directed towards. So I love to see an overhaul of the citizens' arrest law. It's great that that's a bipartisan effort. I think I understand the move towards signing a hate crime law, but I am skeptical at how actually effective it will be at preventing deaths like Ahmaud Arbery's. This is trying to fight, as I say pretty often, trying to fight a culture war with policy, right? And what we see in South Georgia is yet again another example of a history of racism and a history of law enforcement supported racism, you know, ending yet again in the death of an innocent Black person.
Aaron, another notable incident of police brutality in Georgia last year was the police killing of 27-year-old Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta. Remind us about the details in his killing.
Right. So, you know, Rayshard Brooks, it's pretty well known now that, you know, he was essentially stopped on suspicion of DUI. But, you know, it was actually a worker at the Wendy's that called because, you know, Mr. Brooks was asleep in his car. And after an exchange with officers who, you know, essentially wanted to take him in, even though he had parked his car and didn't appear to be posing any threat on anyone, you know, it escalated into a confrontation where they tried to use force to detain him. And then at one point he got he basically got control of an officer's taser. He runs away and he's shot in the back. The officers involved were pretty swiftly charged and brought in on the case, but the case is actually pretty complicated where it stands right now, because it was under the former DA, Paul Howard, who essentially charged the officers without really impaneling a grand jury in the traditional sense. And there are a lot of reasons for why that happened, but now the case is sort of languishing a bit because there's a new DA who's now trying to decide how to proceed.
Josie, how common is it for district attorneys to be able to bring charges against police officers without involving a grand jury, like Aaron just mentioned?
It's fairly uncommon in most states to be able to charge serious violent felonies without involving a grand jury, but it's kind of complicated. I mean, I think it sort of depends state by state. I mean, what we know in general is that the law in every state includes provisions that make it very difficult to convict a law enforcement officer of something like murder, right? Of something like the, you know, in cases like the death of Rayshard Brooks, and or the death of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. And so what is faced by grand juries, by trial juries, by prosecutors, by defense attorneys, and by judges is the general limitations of the law in terms of what the law is willing to do to hold the state accountable. And the reality is they're just not willing to do much. The law protects the state. It does not actually protect the people killed or harmed by the state. And in every jurisdiction, it makes actually getting a conviction against police a very uphill battle.
Let's talk about Daniel Prude. Last March, Prude's family called the police while he was suffering from a mental health crisis in Rochester, New York. Officers placed a mesh hood over his head to use as a spit guard and pressed him into the street until he passed out. Prude died a week later. He was 41. And last week, a grand jury decided not to indict the seven officers involved. Josie, how common is excessive force when police officers are responding to someone suffering from a mental health issue?
Oh, it's extremely common. And it's yet another sign that the fact that police, who are neither trained nor equipped to address mental health crises, it is a travesty that they're actually the people in charge of addressing an emergency like that. You know, if Daniel Prude's family had an option, certainly they would not have wanted to call the cops in a situation where someone is stressing, you know, is struggling from a mental health crisis. If you can imagine being in the throes of a mental health crisis, the cops, even the best cops, are not a reassuring presence. They're not calming, right? What is actually necessary in a situation like that is a trained professional who deals with mental health crises, because that is not who is afforded the right to show up in emergency situations in almost every jurisdiction in the country, save for just a few. We end up in situations like this where people end up dead, right? It is not unusual to see stories like this, where a desperate family loses a family member who's struggling from a mental health problem. And it's going to continue to happen until we actually remove mental health crises from the jurisdiction of police in any way, shape, or form.
Recent reporting from the New York Times found that while the New York State Attorney General has conducted 43 investigations into the killing of unarmed people by police, none have resulted in conviction. Aaron, we have 30 seconds before the break. Could you tell us why that is?
Well, I mean, let's just be clear here, and Josie touched on this already, but, you know, we're 9 months since George Floyd's killing and the nationwide demonstrations over systemic racism. But we still, let's be clear, we still have the very same criminal justice system that we had a year ago, and quite honestly, years. We've had it for years, for decades. There have been calls for, you know, communities to defund police and move resources around and do you know, what Josie just mentioned, which is to make sure that there are trained people out there dealing with you know, incidences as needed. But quite honestly, you know, until the legal framework for prosecuting police officers, you know, changes, we're going to be dealing with the same system.
Last year, the House passed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act, but the Senate didn't bring it up for a vote. What are some of the most notable parts of that legislation?
Well, some of the, you know, a lot of people have described it as the most sweeping legislation on police reform that's really ever been introduced in Congress. And it's really an attempt to undo some of the provisions of the 1994 crime bill that vastly expanded, you know, policing in America and also mass incarceration. It brought us mass incarceration as we know it today. So some of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act provisions calls for, you know, the Justice Department, the federal Justice Department, being able to subpoena police officers, you know, directly for pattern or practice investigations. If you're not familiar with that term, that's a term that's a you know, investigation that was done on Ferguson after the death of Michael Brown, same in Chicago and some other cities around the country. Another provision, they want to ban no-knock raids, which is you know, that procedure or that act, you know, became very popular or very well known as far as a popular call for reform. After the death of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, you know, there's the chokehold ban as that's also being part of the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. Of course, we know the case of Eric Garner here in New York City, but we also, you know, now know the name of George Floyd because of the restraint hold that was placed on him for more than 8 minutes in Minneapolis. So those are just some of the provisions. There's a, when I say sweeping, I mean, there are a lot. I don't want to go through all of them.
Yeah.
But those are some of the things that that the federal lawmakers are really considering. There are some concerns among civil rights advocates and activists that even still, this doesn't go far enough.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the Biden administration in a second. But first, jury selection is set to begin next week in the trial of Derek Chauvin, the officer charged with the second degree murder of George Floyd. Aaron, what will you be watching for?
I think, you know, generally speaking, if you've ever covered a criminal trial, jury selection can either be very dry or it can be pretty revealing about the either side's strategy going into to the trial. So I'll be watching, you know, I won't be in Minneapolis, but I'll certainly be watching from afar. And we've got AP, my AP colleagues that there, they'll be covering it, you know, gavel to gavel all day long. But you know, I'll just be looking for, you know, any signs that we can, that the prosecution or the defense, you know, is tipping their hand about what sort of defense they're going to use or what jury they hope to assemble. And then, you know, we're talking about 2 weeks from now, opening statements. And then from there, we're looking at probably 3 to 4 weeks of a trial. And that will take us, you know, in towards the end of April. So we could have a verdict in Derek Chauvin's trial, you know, before the 1 year anniversary of George Floyd's death.
Huh. Josie, do we have a sense yet of how the Biden administration and the Justice Department are thinking about police reform?
Well, like Aaron said, we know that they have supported some legislation that is a step up from legislation we've seen in the past, right? We know that they plan on reinvigorating pattern and practice investigations from the DOJ, that they plan on trying to impart some sense of accountability in an office that hasn't actually believed in holding the police accountable for the past 4 years, right? Mm. But as far as how far they're willing to go, they're not willing to go as far as many advocates would hope, or even as close to as many advocates as would hope, right? And so not only, for example, do they pose moving funds away from police into other social services, but Biden's actually called for investing $300 million more dollars into quote unquote community policing efforts. And we've seen in the past that community policing as an idea has not been very successful, has resulted in over-policing of already over-policed communities, right? Instead of ensuring that those communities have the resources they need, schools, jobs, the ability to put, you know, food on their kids' tables and other resources, rather than more police. But you know, it's an important thing to remember too that while the executive office sets the tone for the entire nation of how we think about police and police violence, the control that the executive has over police is actually quite minimal. You know, federal grant money, definitely some oversight from DOJ, absolutely. But overall, this is a local issue. It's a state issue. And I hesitate to give even too much attention to the executive's power over policing, because I want people to ensure that they're holding the right officials accountable, talking to their city council, talking to their mayor, talking to their state legislature about policing and policing violence.
In the 30 seconds we have left, Josie, are there specific policies that advocates are pushing for on the local level that they want their local authorities to take up?
Yeah, I think across the nation there is a move towards trying to move police resources elsewhere, right? You know, there's been a lot of conversation about defunding the police, but the case of Daniel Prude's death really emphasizes the reason that, for example, we should not be having police answer mental health crises calls, right? We should not put police in charge of addressing poverty. We should not have police out there punishing people for not having a home. We recognize that policing as it looks today is drastically broader than any of us would design if we were designing a system, right? And so how do we imagine what policing mm-hmm. could look like, and how do we think about that?
Josie Duffy Rice is president of The Appeal. Aaron Morrison is national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
The word justice is non-existent, and that's a fact.
As we just heard, the killings of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others have made us reflect on what justice looks like in the U.S. today. For many Black people and other people of color, the justice system has long been unequal, leaving some to wonder if and how we can make our justice system, well, just. You told us about it.
In this country, justice, Richard Pryor once said, justice means just us.
You go down there looking for justice, that's what you find, just us.
As long as we don't have some form of control, we meaning people of color, in the judicial system, there will never be justice for us. It will always be unbalanced. It has always been, and I believe it will always be. And that's why it's so important for particularly Black people in this country to consider, as I am, getting out of here, leaving this country, and not moving to another country that looks like America, where we're still the minority. Because otherwise, we will not see justice. As long as we're living here, we will never be treated as properly as we should have been. 400 years plus of this nonsense. The word justice is non-existent.
My name is Mary Mallory. I live in suburban Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Sadly, justice no longer seems to be finding right from wrong. It now appears to be right and getting away with it.
So what would real justice look like? And is it even achievable? For many of you, it comes down to one word, accountability.
This is Reverend Nan Baker. I live in Dallas, Texas. And I believe when it comes to the killings, George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Daniel Prude, and so many, many others, justice requires two things that are both essential. Accountability and systemic changes in policing.
I feel very strongly about the fact that in each of those three situations and others, that the police involved should have been charged with murder.
In addition to holding individual officers accountable for these killings, a lot of you also emphasize the need for deep systemic change moving forward.
Hi, this is Andrew in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Justice for me means holding the officers accountable and de-escalating the violence in the future.
Hi, this is Shabri Vickers from Portland, Oregon. Justice is the judgment, conviction, and sentencing of their killers immediately. And beyond those individuals simply being held accountable, justice looks like policies and practice in law enforcement agencies that make what occurred illegal. And in instances like that of Ahmaud Arbery, removing antiquated laws that allow for their ridiculous defense tactics used by lawyers to get them acquitted.
Jury trial, change to the laws for self-policing your neighborhood, and accountability. Jesse from Mobile, Alabama.
What does justice look like for you? Let us know your thoughts by recording and sending a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com, or you can go to thetakeaway.org and click Contact Us to record your answer straight into your computer or your phone. We always love hearing from you, so be a part of our show. During November's elections, many states expanded access to ballots because of the pandemic. Months later, we're now seeing over 100 new bills up for consideration across the country as part of a push to roll back that expansion. And today, the Supreme Court will be hearing a case out of Arizona on one of the most powerful sections of the Voting Rights Act. If the outcome in this case limits the scope of the Voting Rights Act, that could make it harder to challenge some of the voter suppression laws in the pipeline. Here to break it all down is Grace Panetta, senior politics reporter covering elections and voting for Insider. Grace, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much for having me.
Also with us is Mirna Perez, director of the Brennan Center's Voting Rights and Elections Program. Mirna, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I'm excited.
Mirna, we should mention that the Brennan Center submitted a brief to the Supreme Court in the Arizona voting rights case, arguing that the court should uphold the Voting Rights Act. So before we get into the details of this case, can you explain what the Voting Rights Act does?
Sure. The Voting Rights Act has been the crown jewel of the American civil rights movement. It sets forth protections for voters. That way they know when they step in the ballot box, it will be free from racial discrimination in voting. And for more than 50 years, it has provided some of the strongest protections against racial discrimination. In 2013, the Supreme Court weakened the Voting Rights Act by mothballing a particular provision that was really important to protecting voting rights. And today, the Supreme Court will be hearing another matter in which the petitioners and certain amici have invited and in fact encouraged the Supreme Court to further weaken the Voting Rights Act. We are hopeful that the Supreme Court will not do that. It is coming at a time where we need protections against discrimination more than ever. And it's coming at a time where some people feel emboldened about restricting access to the ballot.
Yeah. And Grace, that case before the Supreme Court today, can you tell us a little bit about what it's about?
Absolutely. So it's a couple of cases that are being consolidated for an hour of argument, and they're coming out of Arizona. And In 2016, the Democratic National Committee, the DNC, filed suits against two Arizona voting policies passed in the legislature. The first is a policy that stipulates that any provisional ballots that voters cast in the wrong precinct, a precinct they're not assigned to that is not their own, will be rejected. Even votes for statewide races at the top of the ticket that any voter in the state is eligible for. And the second law that is being challenged here is a law banning third-party ballot collection. Ballot collection drives are a really key tool in Arizona because so much of the state's electorate votes by mail in a given election. Mm. And so the DNC challenged these laws under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, contending that they resulted in the denial of abridgment of the right to vote for voters of color under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. They first lost in the district court and in a panel of the Ninth Circuit, but the en banc Ninth Circuit reversed, finding that both the laws did in fact violate Section 2 and that the ballot collection policy was in fact created with discriminatory intent. And now Arizona is appealing that to the Supreme Court.
And can you explain what Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is?
Absolutely. So Section 2 prohibits any denial or abridgment or discrimination of voting specifically for racial minorities and language minorities in the United States. And the way that Congress has, you know, construed this law is that it not only covers cases of intentional discrimination, but it should also cover cases that result of laws or policies that result in a discriminatory intent. So Section 2 has been used by both the Department of Justice and other plaintiffs to challenge both discriminatory voting schemes, so in the redistricting context with schemes that dilute the weights of minority voters and also against certain policies.
So Section 2 is a crucial part of the Voting Rights Act, especially since the legislation was weakened in 2013, as you mentioned, Mirna, after a Supreme Court ruling. Explain again what happened then and why.
Sure. In 2013, the Supreme Court considered a crucial part of the Voting Rights Act called Section 5, or sometimes known as preclearance. Preclearance is just a fancy way for saying that before an election change is about to be implemented, it needs to be certified in advance that it's not going to make minority voters worse off, or that it wasn't enacted with the hopes of making minority voters worse off. Section 5 applied in jurisdictions that had histories of racial discrimination in voting. The Supreme Court decided in 2013 that Congress had not looked at recent enough information to decide which states and localities had to comply with the Section 5 preclearance requirements. And once it, and so while we have preclearance or Section 5 on the books, we don't have it operating anywhere. It's kind of like imagining that you have a really strong, beautiful, shiny, powerful car, but it has to sit on a lawn. And so Section 2, as Grace mentioned, has been doing a lot of the work that Section 5 used to. Litigators like myself have been using Section 2 across the country to try and stop restrictive and discriminatory policies because we don't have the tool of Section 5 anymore. And the concern today is that the Supreme Court is going to take up the invitation that the defendants and that the amici have put in front of them saying to further weaken the Voting Rights Act by weakening or limiting Section 2. I do think it's important to note that this could be a very straightforward application of law to facts. The Supreme Court could decide that it's merely going to examine whether or not the facts on the ground in Arizona violate Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And what is, I think, particularly dangerous is the very naked assault on this bedrock protection for the right to vote. They are being very loud and very clear that they want the court to weaken the protections. And so even if the court declines to do it, the fact that we have really powerful forces in this country trying to make it easier to get away with discrimination is something that we should all be concerned about, especially when we see this anti-voter activity in the states.
Grace, talk to us about the broader context of what is happening in many states around the country in the aftermath of the 2020 election and how that relates to this case.
Absolutely. So as Brennan Center Research has found, they've put out a really excellent guide laying out the landscape on voting laws in state legislatures around the country. There are now over 160 bills seeking to restrict voting that have been filed in state legislatures around the country in the wake of the 2020 election, which is, you know, a significant increase over the number that had been filed around the same time last year. And while not all of them, you know, are going to pass or even make it through committee, it sort of signals where certain legislators' priorities are. And in many states, including Arizona, which has legislators have filed many, many bills seeking to restrict voting, this really has significant implications for how these laws could be challenged. Because as Mirna mentioned, Section 2 has become one of the main tools of litigation that litigators have used to challenge laws that are discriminatory. And so if the court rules, for example, that Section 2 should only be applied to narrow circumstances of vote dilution schemes, or if they say that a narrower test should be used, a higher threshold, if they rule that litigants have to prove discriminatory intent or somehow make it harder to bring these claims, that could make it much more difficult to challenge some of these laws that have a disparate impact on voters of color.
Mirna, one part of today's case is about requiring election officials to discard ballots cast at the wrong precinct. Why are communities of color especially impacted by this?
Well, to be very clear, it's not a question as to whether or not these kinds of policies, it's whether or not this policy in Arizona is discriminatory. And the facts presented that the Ninth Circuit found very persuasive were that Arizona had a history of moving around precincts. And so, especially in communities of color, and they did not provide appropriate voter education, and they did not provide appropriate training to poll workers as to what people should do. So you would have limited information voters going to a polling place that wasn't in fact theirs, and then they'd cast a ballot and the entirety of the ballot would be rejected. That's why what the defendants and what the amici are asking the Supreme Court to do is so incredibly outrageous. This is not a nationwide referendum on whether or not people can discard ballots if they cast them in the wrong precinct. It is whether or not this is a problem in Arizona under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. And we should be appalled that there are some people asking the court to consider the constitutionality and consider the strength of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act when we're really just looking at what is on the ground and what is happening in Arizona.
Grace, some are saying that this is the most important election case in almost a decade. What makes it so crucial?
Yeah, what makes it so crucial is it strikes at one of the last remaining really strong parts of federal election law that protects minority voters. As Myrna mentioned earlier, now with the preclearance under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act gone, this sort of crown jewel of the civil rights movement, its power has really been diminished and taken away specifically by the Supreme Court. And the other reason that makes it so important is that, you know, in the past year, especially with all the election cases coming out of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Supreme Court hasn't been the friendliest arena for voting rights advocates. And with a case of this magnitude and this significance, it could, you know, not only have an impact on how these cases can be litigated nationwide and make it more difficult to challenge discriminatory laws, but it could also signal, you know, how the court is going to continue to handle these issues. And it could make litigants, you know, in this case, think differently about what cases they want to put in that pipeline up to the court.
Grace Panetta is a senior politics reporter covering elections and voting for Insider, and Myrna Perez is the director of the Brennan Center's Voting Rights and Elections Program. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Rebecca Ibarra, filling in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. For years, Puerto Rico has faced crisis after crisis, and last week, a new podcast was launched to help us understand what these many crises mean.
When I hear or use La Brega, I'm referring to the struggle.
The struggle?
Lucha, viene del hustle.
Selling el hustle.
In the hustle, a hustle.
La Brega has to deal with everyday life. I call it cotidianidad.
Determinación, sobrevivencia, trabajo.
Determination, survival, work.
Ways to do something in circumstances that don't let you get ahead.
Grinding.
You know what it means. You need to do it.
I commonly use it when someone asks me, what are you up to or how are you doing? I'm cruising along.
Buscando, continuamente buscando algo.
Searching, continually searching for something.
Showcasing our true Puerto Rican brilliance.
That's from La Brega, a new podcast from WNYC Studios and Futuro Studios. It tells the stories of the Puerto Rican experience, and it couldn't come at a better time as Puerto Rico continues to rebuild from recent natural disasters and struggles with a mounting debt crisis. And we're happy to have Alana Casanova Burgess, host of La Brega, here. Alana, bienvenida.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what exactly is La Brega? What does that mean?
Well, it's a word that exists in Spanish, but in Puerto Rico, we use it in a very specific way, and we also use it all the time. So it refers to a struggle that you have, a challenge, something that you can't really solve, but you have to find a way around it. So you have a little edge of creativity to it. We might say, if somebody asks you how you're doing, you might say, ah, aquí en la brega. It has a lot to do with tone as well. You know, you don't really have to say any more than that. I mean, so I'm not doing well, I'm not doing poorly, but, you know, I'm just here trying to survive. It can also be kind of playful, like, oh my God, that's so cute. No puedo bregar. I can't deal with that. But, you know, in this term, in this podcast, we're really trying to interrogate why it is that we use this word so often to struggle.
Yeah. So when making a podcast about Puerto Rico, why did you decide to call it La Brega?
Honestly, the name came after all the episodes. We realized that these all had individual bregas and collective bregas. So we have people really at the heart of every episode of every story we're telling, but then they all also speak to a collective struggle that someone has, whether it's to try to get public health care in Vieques or to try to negotiate the federal bureaucracy around the debt crisis or even the island status. These are all bregas, and the word just comes up so naturally in conversation in Puerto Rico that we, and among the diaspora here in the States, that we wanted to pay homage to that.
Alana, this show is so Puerto Rican, but it also actually reminds me of Mexico, my hometown, or really any country where citizens have had to be resilient because the state has failed them. And then this resilience ends up being worn as a badge of honor. So did that come across to you in the people you've talked to? And why do you think that is?
I'm so glad you said that, because it is something that we've been thinking about a lot on the team. You know, after Maria especially, there was a lot of talk, a lot of celebration about Puerto Rican resilience. And as we mentioned in the first episode, you know, that can kind of get a little nauseating. Like, why are we celebrating how difficult it was and continues to be after Maria to survive in Puerto Rico? So we've been trying to think also about when a brega is good, right? Mm-hmm. When it's good to be creative and survive and find your way and meet a struggle, and when just la brega is too hard and maybe we need to take a step back and think more about the systemic structures that are making life that way.
Let's break down one of the major themes you cover in the podcast. Walk us through the relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico. How has it evolved in recent years?
Well, some people might not realize that Puerto Rico's colonial status actually has a particular name, the Estado Libre Asociado, the Free Associated State. And that is a status that was created in 1952 with a new constitution for Puerto Rico. And you can kind of hear it in the name, right? Estado Libre Asociado. It's not a state, it's not free, but it is associated. And we actually have an episode about how that is really a brega that hasn't been working recently, right? It's the idea of decolonization as a challenge that couldn't really be met head on. So there was this sort of creative brega of the ELA, the Estado Libre Asociado. And in recent years, you know, we've seen the debt crisis, the recovery in quotation marks from Hurricane Maria, the pandemic. We've seen so many ways that brega is not working.
There's so much good sound in this podcast. I want to play some. So your team found this great piece of archival tape for the podcast from CBS in the 1970s. Let's listen.
60% of Puerto Rican families are living on incomes below the federal government's poverty level. 60% of Puerto Rico's inhabitants need food stamp help. Whatever the past virtues of the island's relations with the United States, today's troubles raise some basic questions about this system in the future. And some argue flatly, it no longer works.
Tell us about this piece of tape.
So that piece of tape is from 1975. And when we heard that tape, we realized, wow, you know, the conversation that has been going on around status with Puerto Rico has been just stuck in the same rut for decades. And lately, you know, we've seen protests on the island. We've seen, as the takeaway discussed last week, a tax shelter in Puerto Rico for people to move there, like Logan Paul, for example. And we see that the conversation around status is really stuck in the same place. We're just having the same conversation over and over again. That piece of tape is from 1975, could have been aired on CBS yesterday.
One of the most fascinating episodes concerns the independence movement on the island. Can you tell us what that episode is about and what exactly are las carpetas?
Well, las carpetas, it's a word for folder, but in Puerto Rico, it has this very particular meaning because it refers to a surveillance program that ran for decades on the island from the 40s until the 80s, where people who were associated or even associated with people who were associated with the independence movement would be surveilled by secret Puerto Rican police in collaboration with the FBI. And if you were interested in the independence movement, for example, you could be blacklisted from jobs. They might call your professor at the university and warn them that you were a troublemaker, that you were dangerous with your ideas. And so Las Carpetas, we have an episode in the series, is about what happened when these folders were actually returned to the people who were surveilled and a lot of the personal relationships that it strained when that came to light.
This podcast is bilingual, which means you are releasing all the episodes in both English and Spanish. So it's 14 episodes total. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, there are so many Puerto Ricans in the States who don't speak Spanish. And there are obviously Puerto Ricans on the island who do not speak English. And then also, these are just great stories for anybody to enjoy. So we thought that it was important to have both languages represented and to really not leave anybody out of the conversation.
Alana, when it comes to telling stories of Puerto Rico and about Puerto Ricans, what did you learn while making this podcast that other news outlets or media can do differently?
You know, every episode in this series is reported by a different Puerto Rican journalist, and they are all experts in their field. They are experts in what it means to be Puerto Rican from their perspective. Obviously, there are lots of perspectives. And so we really tried to center what it means to tell our own stories. And I think that that's important. I know it matters to The Takeaway. It matters to lots of news outlets. But the fact that it's something that still mainstream media really struggles with, I think is telling. And we're hoping to bring the diaspora and the island together in this effort with a podcast.
Alana Casanova Burgess is the host of La Brega from WNYC Studios and Futuro Studios. You can get it wherever you get your podcasts. Alana, thank you so much for joining us.
Gracias, Rebecca.
And that's the show for today, folks. It was such a pleasure being here with you. And of course, give us a call if you have any thoughts or show ideas at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. You can also tweet me at Rebe Ibarra C. We can also take your voice memos, record them on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Rebecca Ibarra in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.